In the darkness under the spathodia trees, Colonel Roland Ballantyne took the unit reports as they came in. With each negative show, his frustration increased. Their information had been good, and the scent was hot. It was a scent he had followed often before. Comrade Tebby was one of their prime targets. He was a Zebra commissar who had been operating within Matabele land for almost 7 months now. They had been as close to him as this on three other occasions. It always seemed to be the same. The tip from one of the informers, or from a member of the scouts operating under civilian cover. Tebby was in such and such a village. They would move up silently and surround it, methodically closing every bolt hole. Then in the darkness and bleakest hour of the night, they would go in and sweep. Once they had taken two of his lieutenants, but Tebby was not with them. The regimental sergeant major of the scouts, Esau Gondele, had questioned the two terrorists while Roland watched. By dawn, neither of them were able to stand up any longer, but they had not spoken. "Use the chopper," Roland ordered. They hovered at 2,000 feet, while Sergeant Major Gondele hung the most defiant terrorist from the belly hatch, holding him by the webbing belt looped up under his armpits. "Tell me, my friend, where will we find your comrade Tebby?" The man had twisted his head up sideways and tried to spit at Esau Gondele, but the downdraft of the spinning rotors had blown his spittle away. The Sergeant Major had glanced at Roland, and when he nodded, opened his fist. The terrorist had fallen 2,000 feet, turning slowly end over end. Perhaps he was past screaming, or perhaps it was his final defiance, but he was utterly silent during the drop. Sergeant Major Gondele had reached for the second terrorist and looped a webbing under his armpits. As he lowered him out of the hatch, his bound feet dangling 2,000 feet above the golden Matabele grasslands, the man had looked up and said, "I will tell you." However, they had held out for just 30 minutes too long. When the scouts hit the safe house in hillside location, Comrade Tebby had moved again. Roland Ballantyne's frustration was corrosive. The week before, Comrade Tebby had left an explosive device in a supermarket chariot. It had killed 7 people, all of them female, 2 of them under 10 years of age. Roland wanted him very badly. So badly that when he realized that once again he had escaped, a kind of heavy black feeling closed down over half his mind. "Bring the informer," he ordered, and Esau Gondele spoke softly into the portable radio. Within minutes, they heard the Land Rover coming up the hill, and its headlights flickered through the trees of the forest. "All right, Sergeant Major, get those people lined up." There were 60 or so of them lined up along the verge of the road in front of the low row of staff cottages. The searchlights trapped them in a stark and merciless glare. Colonel Roland Ballantyne vaulted up onto the back of the Land Rover and held the bullhorn to his lips. He spoke in perfectly colloquial Cinderbailey. "The evil ones have been amongst you. They have left the stink of death on this village. They have come here to plan destruction, to kill and cripple you and your children. You should have come to us, that we might protect you. Because you were afraid to ask for our help, you have brought even greater hardship upon yourselves." The long line of black people, men and women and children, still in their nightclothes, stood stolidly and stoically as cattle in the crush. They were caught between the millstones of the guerrillas on the one side and the security forces on the other. They stood in the white searchlights and listened. "Your government is your father. Like a good father, it seeks to protect its children. However, there are stupid children amongst you, those who conspire with the evil ones, those who feed them and give them news and warn them when we come. We know these things. We know who warned them." At Roland's feet, sitting on the crossbench of the Land Rover, was a human figure. It was draped from head to foot in a single sheet of cloth, so that it was impossible to tell whether it was a man or a woman. There were eye holes cut in the hood of the cloth. "We will now smell out the evil ones amongst you, those who give comfort to the death-bringers," Roland told them. The Land Rover rolled slowly along the line of villages, and as it drew level with each man or woman, The soldier shone his flashlight into the person's face at a range of only a few feet. In the open back of the vehicle, the mysteriously robed and masked figure stared out of the eye holes in the sheet. The dark eyes gleamed in the reflected light of the flashlight as they examined each face. The veiled informer sat unmovingly as the Land Rover came on at a walking pace, down towards where Samson and Constance supported the old man between them. Without moving his lips, Samson asked her, "Is it safe? Do they know you?"
"I do not know," she answered him. "What can we do?"
But by that time the Land Rover was drawing level with where they stood, and Constance did not have time to reply. In the rear of the vehicle, the masked figure moved for the first time. A long black arm shot out from under the sheet and pointed directly into Constance's upturned face. Not a word was spoken, but two of the camouflaged scouts stepped out of the darkness behind her and seized her arms.
"Constance!"
Samson ran forward and reached for her. A rifle butt smashed into his back at the level of his kidneys, and flaming agony tore up his spine and burst against the roof of his skull. He dropped to his knees. Pain distorted his vision, and the flashlight shone into his face, blinding him. He pushed himself upright with a violent effort, but found that the muzzle of an FN rifle was pressed into his stomach. "We don't want you, my friend. Do not interfere in what does not concern you." The scouts were leading Constance away. She went docilely. She seemed very small and helpless between the two tall soldiers in full battle dress. She turned and looked back at Samson. Her great soft eyes clung to his face, and her lips moved. Then for an instant, the body of the Land Rover blocked the beam of the searchlight. Darkness enveloped the group, and a second later, when the searchlight caught them again, Constance had broken away from her captors, and she was running.
"No!"
screamed Samson in terrible agony. He knew what was about to happen.
"Stop, Constance, stop!"
She flew like a lovely moth in the light, the pink of her dress flitting between the trunks of the spathodia trees. And then the bullets ripped chunks of white, wet wood from the trees about her. And she was no longer swift and graceful. It was as though the moth's wings had been shredded by a spiteful child. Four soldiers carried her body back, each of them holding a leg or an arm. Constance's head hung back almost to touch the ground, and the blood from her nostrils and mouth running down her cheeks was thick and black as treacle in the searchlights. They tossed her up into the back of the Land Rover, where she lay in a tangle of dark limbs, like a gazelle shot on the hunting field. Samson Kumalo walked down the main street of Bulawayo. The cool of the night still lingered, and the shadows of the jacaranda trees threw tiger stripes across the blue macadam surface. He mingled easily with the lazy flow of humanity along the sidewalk, and he made no effort to avert his face as he passed a BSA police constable in his blue and khaki uniform and pith helmet on the corner of the park. While he waited for the traffic lights, he watched the faces about him, the flat, incurious expression of the Matabele, their eyes veiled defensively, the bright young white matrons in pretty floral dresses going about their shopping with a handbag on one shoulder and a machine pistol on the other. There were very few white men in the streets, and most of those too old for military service. The others were all uniformed and armed. The traffic that crossed the intersection in front of him was mostly military. Since the imposition of economic sanctions, the gasoline ration had been reduced to a few litres a month. The farmers coming into town for the day drove the ungainly mine-proofed machines with blast deflectors and armoured bodies. Samson was aware for the first time since Constance's death of the true extent of his hatred as he watched their white faces. Before today there had been a numbness in him that was anaesthetic, but that was fading. He carried no luggage, for a parcel would immediately have attracted attention and invited a body search. He wore jeans and a short-sleeved shirt and gym shoes, no jacket that might have concealed a weapon. And like the other Matabele around him, his face was blank and expressionless. He was armed only with his hatred. The lights changed, and he crossed the road unhurriedly and turned down towards the bus station. Even this early it was crowded. There were patient queues of peasants waiting to make the journey back to the tribal trust lands. All of them were loaded with their purchases, bags of meal and salt, tins of cooking oil or paraffin, bundles of material and cardboard boxes of other luxuries, of matches and soap and candles. They squatted under the iron roofs of the shelters, chattering and laughing, chewing roasted maize cobs, drinking Coca-Cola, some of the mothers feeding their infants from the breast or scolding their toddlers. Every few minutes a bus would draw up, in greasy clouds of diesel exhaust, to discharge a horde of passengers, and immediately they were replaced from the endless queues. Samson leaned against the wall of the public latrines. It was the most central position, and he settled himself to wait. He did not at first recognize Comrade Terby. He wore a filthy, tattered blue overall with Cohen's Butchery embroidered across the back in red letters. His careless stoop disguised his height, and an expression of moronic goodwill made him appear harmless. He passed Samson without a glance in his direction and entered the latrine. Samson waited a few seconds before he followed him. The toilet reeked of cheap tobacco smoke and stale urine. It was crowded, and Comrade Terby jostled against Samson and slipped a blue cardboard ticket into his hand. In one of the cabinets, Samson examined it. It was a single third-class ticket, Bulawayo to Victoria Falls. He took his place in the Victoria Falls queue, five places behind Terby. The bus was 35 minutes late, and there was the usual rush to heave luggage onto the roof racks and find a seat. Terby was in a window seat three rows ahead of Samson. He never looked round while the heavily loaded red bus lumbered out through the northern suburbs. They passed the long avenue of jacaranda trees that Cecil Rhodes had planted, and which led up to the gabled state house on the hill above the town, where once the royal kraal of Lobengula, king of the Matabele, had stood. They passed the turnoff to the airport and reached the first roadblock. Every passenger was forced to dismount and identify his luggage. It was opened and searched by the constables manning the roadblock, and then a random selection of men and women was made for body searching. Neither Samson nor Terby was amongst those selected, and 15 minutes later the bus was reloaded and allowed to pass. As they roared on northwards, the acacia and savanna swiftly gave way to stately forest. Samson crouched on the hard bench and watched it pass. Ahead of him, Terby appeared to be sleeping. A little before noon, they reached the stop for St. Matthew's Mission on the Gwai River, at the edge of the Sikumi Forest Reserve. Most of the passengers fetched their luggage down from the roof racks and trudged away along the web of footpaths that led into the forest. "We will stop here for 1 hour," the uniformed driver told the others. "You can make a fire and cook your meal." Terby caught Samson's eye and sauntered away towards the little general dealer's store at the crossroads. When Samson followed him into the building, he did not at first find Terby. Then he saw the door behind the counter was ajar, and the proprietor made a small gesture of invitation towards it. Terby was waiting for him in the back room, amongst the piles of maize sacks and dried skins, the cartons of carbolic soap, and the crates of cold drinks. He had shed the ragged overalls, and with them the character of the indolent labourer. "I see you, Comrade Samson," he said quietly. "That is my name no longer," Samson answered. "What is your name?"
"Tungata Zabiwe."
"I see you, Comrade Tungata." Terby nodded with satisfaction. "You worked in the game department. You understand guns, do you not?" Terby did not wait for an answer. He opened one of the metal bins of ground meal and stood against the rear wall. He brought out a long bundle wrapped in a green plastic agricultural fertilizer bag and dusted off the powdery white meal. He undid the twine that secured it and handed the weapon that it contained to Tungata Zubiwe, who recognized it instantly. In the early days of the Bush War, the security forces had mounted a publicity campaign to tempt informers to report the presence of guerrilla weapons in their villages. They had used television spots and newspaper advertisements. In the remote tribal trust areas, they had made massive aerial drops of illustrated pamphlets, all offering a $5,000 reward for information leading to the recovery of a single one of these. It was a 7.62mm automatic Kalashnikov AK assault rifle. Tungata took it in his hands and found it surprisingly heavy for its size. Unlike most NATO weapons, it was made not of metal-stamped components, but of milled steel. The butt and stock were of laminated wood. "These are their magazines," the Rhodesians called it the banana gun, because of these characteristic curved magazines. "Loading the mags," Tebby demonstrated, pushing the short, light brass cartridges down into the mouth with his thumb. "Try it." Tungata was immediately competent. He had the second magazine loaded with its full 30 rounds in as many seconds. "Good," Tebby nodded again, the wisdom of his choice confirmed. "Now to load the rifle, you do like this." He pressed the forward end of the magazine into the receiver slot and then tilted the rear end upwards. There was a click as the catch engaged.